When Alan Zweibel graduated from college, he had two choices. He could go to law school, or he could try to be a comedy writer. When no school accepted him, he started writing jokes for the comics who worked the resorts in New York's Catskill Mountains. Since then, he's won 3 Emmys. He wrote for the original cast of Saturday Night Live and co-created It's Gary Shandling Show. Zweibel's latest project is The Boys, a sitcom for the Showtime cable channel. It's set in a fading New York City men's club that's struggling to keep up with the times. Most of its members are old comics and celebrities, not unlike those Zweibel first wrote jokes for or later met at New York's Friars Club.
It's the kind of place where you'd look around on any given afternoon and you'd see Mayor Abe Beam having lunch with Wilt Chamberlain. And you go, my God, what could they possibly be talking about? And it was just the juxtaposition of these varied personalities and this club that had this historic kind of air to it, beginning with Gershwin and Mayor Jimmy Walker and LaGuardia and Babe Ruth and all those people that intrigued me. So when I got the opportunity to do a show about a club like it, I did.
Now, you used to write for comics. You wrote for Borscht Belt comics, the comics who play the Catskills?
I started that way. I started writing for men like Morty Gunty and mm-hmm. Freddie Roman and Dick Capri and Dick Lord and Vic Arnell. And it goes on and on and on. Thousands of Bernies, thousands of Mickeys, hundreds of Lees. And ultimately, I started off writing for $7 a joke. And this was right out of college, which was 1972. And to supplement this terrific living that I was making, I was also working in a delicatessen in Queens. And you name it, I sliced it for about 3 years. And what I used to do was sell jokes to these comedians and write down jokes on paper bags and then shove them in my pocket and sell it to them.
What was the first joke that you sold?
You know something? One of the first jokes that I had ever written and no one paid me for was one of the first jokes that we did years later on Saturday Night Live, which was about a stamp, the post office coming out with a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. It was an 8-cent stamp. If you want to lick it, it's a quarter. And are you allowed to say that on this radio show? We did it on Saturday night. I mean, that just goes to show you how long ago that joke was written, because I don't believe they have 8-cent stamps anymore. And it was those kinds of lines that that the people I was writing for said, they're funny, but it's not for my audience. You know, these were by and large blue-haired ladies who went to resorts on the weekends and on major holidays.
So did you have to write mother-in-law jokes, honeymoon night jokes?
Oh, God, yeah. Don't touch me. I just had my hair done jokes, sending the kids to camp jokes, all the cliche kind of jokes. And it was incredibly frustrating. In its own way, it was like, well, it was great in a way. In one way, it was like writing for your father, But what was very, very interesting about it, and which was a great training ground, is what your ear got accustomed to was the way different people spoke. All right? See, what I used to do as a matter of self-discipline was I'd wake up on a Monday morning and I'd say, okay, this week we're going to talk about cars, right? So on Monday, I would write a monologue as if Woody Allen were to deliver it about buying a car. Tuesday, I would do it as if I'd write a monologue for Joan Rivers about buying a car. Wednesday, Rodney Dangerfield. Every single day, I'd take the same topic and try to put it in the mouths of other people just as a way of training myself.
Did you ever have to write jokes with Yiddish punchlines?
Oh, it's really amazing in that I used to write for a lot of the Friars roasts, where they used to roast somebody once or twice a year. And those, by and large, are stag. And what you can do is you can get laughs if you just say a couple of words and then throw in a dirty word. The shock value would get a laugh. And the same thing for a lot of these comedians. If I would just say, yesterday I bought a new chair, Rosh Hashanah, and they'd start laughing, the audience. I mean, just totally out of context. You know what I mean? If you just put in like the name of a Jewish holiday or a recipe, they would laugh.
What's an example of a way a comic really ruined one of your jokes?
Oh, that's a tough question. this isn't the perfect answer to it, but I think it sort of answers a question. Years and years later, after I had stopped writing for these stand-up comedians, I was now married, and we went up to the Concord Hotel for like a ski weekend, and we went with Al Franken, who used to be a co-writer with me on Saturday Night Live, he and his family. And we were up at the Concord, and we went in to see the show, and on the bill was a man who I used to write for. And I'm sitting there, and I recognized much of the material. Now, let's say this was 1986. I hadn't written for this man since 1973. Okay, so let's see, this is 13 years have gone by, and I'm recognizing the jokes as by and large the same. We went backstage afterwards to see him, or I met him in the bar afterwards, and we said hi to each other, and we got to talking, and he said, "How do you like the show?" And I said, "Terrific, really good." And he said, "You see, I'm still doing your stuff. It's still holding up." I said, "Yeah, I'm flattered." He said, "Any suggestions?" I said, "Well, one minor suggestion. You know that joke that you do about the Secretary of State?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "So I could be wrong, but as far as I'm concerned, you might get a better laugh if you took out Kissinger's name and put in George Shultz's."
And you're kidding.
No, this was 1986, and I had written in 1973 when Kissinger was, you know, and he'd never bothered taking out the old guy's name, and so he was doing it still in the present.
See, I find this incredibly depressing. I mean, are you depressed by that?
On one level, it's somewhat depressing. On another level, you're dealing with, in a few instances, with people who are sort of blissful and unaffected. And there's something nice about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not trying to wax romantic about it. But if somebody could be off by that much, do you know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to be cruel. It's
right.
Like, God, my guess is that they sleep better than I do.
Did you ever go through a period of thinking, geez, I really wanted to be Lenny Bruce. How come I'm running for all these Catskill guys?
You mean back then?
Yeah.
Well, the motivation to get up and do it myself was not so much to be Lenny Bruce, because I never wanted to be a performer. I always dreamed of becoming a writer. However, what I wanted to say was certainly more than the circular driveway jokes that I was writing for these comedians, which is why when I did my act, which was a little bit more politically bent and a little bit more quote-unquote current and topical at the time, I was very fortunate that one night, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was having the hardest time. I was about 4 months into this, my stand-up career, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was having an awful hard time making four drunks from Wyoming laugh. This was at Catch a Rising Star. And I got off the stage sweating like a pig, and I went to the bar, and this guy approaches me, and he introduced himself. He said his name was Lorne Michaels, and this was in, I believe, April of 75. And he said, he just looked at me and said, "You know, I don't mind telling you that you're the worst comedian that I've ever seen in my life." I go, "Yeah, I know, I'm going to die. I have no idea what I'm going to do here." And he said, "Well, the material is good. Did you write it?" And I said, "Yeah, I did." He said, "Well, I have this new show that's going to be starting next fall. It's going to be called Saturday Night Live, and I'm looking for writers. Would you mind showing me more of your material?" And I said, "You bet." So I went home, which was my parents' house on Long Island, and I stayed up for 2 days straight, typing out what I thought were 1,100 of my best jokes. And I went back into the city and went to Lauren's hotel, showed him the material, and a couple of days later he gave me a job. And that was the end of my stand-up career, and it was beginning, and that was my big break. So, you know, the Lenny Bruce part, which is the answer to your question, I found that by being able to write my first job ever for a show like Saturday Night Live, and be able to speak, if you will, through Chevy Chase on Weekend Update and Gilda and Belushi and Aykroyd and do the things that we did and write the things that these guys were saying and acting, I was able to express myself in a way that was probably more characteristic of how I felt, humor-wise and every other way, than, like I said, when I was doing the Jewish holiday jokes up in the Catskills.
You did a lot of writing for Gilda Radner and wrote, what, Emily Latella and Roseanne Roseanna Dana? With
Amongst
her?
Other things, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was there something about her as an actress or as a writer that worked for you as a writer?
Oh, yeah.
Were there traits in her that brought out qualities that were good in you and vice versa?
Oh, yeah. We had always kidded about it in that she was a great writer, undisciplined in that she wouldn't sit down at a typewriter and stay up all night, you know. However, whenever we would write together, it was usually by virtue of me taking a legal pad and a pen and the two of us going to a restaurant, and I would basically interview her on whatever we were going to do that week, whether it was Roseanne, Roseanna Dana, Emily Latella, any of the other things that I'd written for her. I'd say, okay, how do you feel about this? Or what would Roseanne say about that?
Mm-hmm. So you co-created the Emily Latella character with her?
That was that was based on a character that it was a nanny that was very, very important in Gilda's upbringing. A woman who's still alive, I believe she's 97 or 98 years old, her name was Dibby, and spoke like that. The character first appeared in a sketch that either Franken and Davis wrote or Rosie Schuster, and wasn't named as such, and then we started using it more and more, and then ultimately Gilda and I hooked into it and put her in Weekend Update, and the character evolved into what it was.
Tonight's commentary is very important, because I hear that President Ford wants to make Puerto Rico a steak. Now, why does he have to make the mistake? I didn't think those people even liked meat. Now, let me warn What's on. All this fuss I keep hearing about violins on television? Now, why don't parents want their children to see violins on television? I say there should be more violins on television and less game shows. It's terrible the way things... What?
Mr. Teller, that was violence on television, not violins. Violence.
Oh, well, that's different.
Yes.
Never mind.
Can you describe the creation of the Roseanne Roseanna Dana character?
Well, there was once a sketch called Hire the Incompetent that I believe Rosie Schuster wrote, where Gilda appeared with that wig. And Hire the Incompetent was a interviews with three people who were clearly too incompetent to have any job anywhere. And it was successful. And months later, I was having dinner with Gilda, and I said, you know, remember that character? I said, why don't we give her a name, put her in Weekend Update, and why not give her, you know, let her be a consumer advocate, not unlike, and there was a local ABC newswoman called Roseanne Scamardella in New York at the time. I said, not unlike Roseanne Scamardella. And Gilda said, well, okay, can we call her Roseanne Roseanna Dana? And I said, why? And what Gilda had done, remember that song, The Name Game, you know, Johnny, Johnny,
yeah.
Bobani? Gilda started singing it, and if you sing it with the name Roseanne, somewhere in there, Roseanne Roseanna Dana comes out. And I go, okay, fine, let's name her that. So every week, she would get a letter from a Richard Fader from Fort Lee, New Jersey, who's my brother-in-law. He was my best friend growing up, then he married my sister, and it was my way of saying hi to him every week. So we made him the letter writer. And basically we lapsed into a formula where we would take a celebrity and we would take something topical and we would put the two together and come up with sweat balls at the end of Dr. Joyce Brothers' nose or nasal hairs from Bo Derek or whatever we did.
She opens her perfect little purse and takes out a perfect little Kleenex and draws her perfect little fez and then throws a perfect little Kleenex into a perfect little Tiffany trash can. But what this cutie didn't know was when she wiped off her nose, she didn't push back in this one little perfect little nose hair. It just stuck out there. And it was long and it was black and it was perfect and I thought I was gonna die. Just between you and me, Roseanne, Roseanna, Dana, I felt like yanking down two more hairs, braiding them, and putting a bead at the end. Then, her nose will look like her head. But I yelled, hey, bull! Doctor Philippe, not
Roseanne. Roseanne.
You left Saturday Night Live in 1980. Were you in the position of having to be a salesman for your own ideas after that? You know, trying to sell screenplays or TV show ideas, things like that?
Sure. Many doors opened for us in 1980 because we were coming off the show, which was very hot at the time. Although, admittedly, we were in this womb for 5 years. It was, for many of us, it was the first job we ever had in television. And you would write something on Wednesday, and it would be seen by millions of people 3 days later,
mm-hmm.
or in the case of Weekend Update, write it that morning or that evening and see it on television hours later. And then to start writing screenplays or pilots, which even if they saw the light of day, wouldn't be for a year, it was like a little bit of a birth trauma.
Okay. Oh, one last thing. Any TV shows that changed your life or your fantasy life?
Those are two separate questions.
You're right.
I think that the old Dick Van Dyke show, the one where he and Mary Tyler Moore lived in New Rochelle and had a child, and he wrote for the Alan Brady show, I think I was around 14 years old when that came on the air, and it was in watching that show that I decided that that's not only what I wanted to do for a living, but also wanted to have that kind of life, have a wife and kids and live in a suburban atmosphere, and it just seemed neat. So that would probably be at the top of my list.
Do you feel like you have a Dick Van Dyke show kind of life now?
I think so. I think it's a little bit more complicated. He only had one kid, and I have three. And right now we're trying to negotiate living on two coasts, which is in and itself trying. But I think by and large that's what I always aspired to be and how to live. So I think so, yes.
Alan Zweipel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.